The Chris Perillo Show is brought to you by Microsoft Windows Media. Download Windows Media Player 10 at Microsoft.com/Windows Media.
On Sunday night, right around 2 in the morning, Ponzi and I were watching like some kind of movie. She went out to Blockbuster Video and picked up a couple of movies. Much to my chagrin, I say she should be using our Netflix account, but you know, sometimes she just wants to get something. So we were watching the movie, and I was like, oh, this is kind of boring. You know, it was like some independent flick. So I went to the other room, you know, checked my RSS feeds. All my search feeds came in. And I go to my PubSub folder for the Locker Gnome search in NewsGator. And I saw probably about 200 messages in there. And I was like, there's no way all these are legit. There's no way. I'm not that popular. So I started looking at them. And I could just tell from the subject line that they were spam. And every single one of them was spam. Not one legitimate search. And they were all coming from Blogspot. Now, this has been a problem for a while. This isn't just new. This just wasn't, you know, Sunday at 2 in the morning new. It's been happening for quite some time, where I'll get legitimate results and then a handful of spam results in a search feed. What's happening, essentially, is that sploggers, spam blogs, or splogs, and people who post blogs or sploggers, are essentially taking content, scraping content, and then using a piece of software to automatically generate a URL, a Blogspot URL, and then send people, from that link, send people off to their own links, wherever they want them to go. So essentially, they're taking popular keywords, populating a fake blog, a splog, and then in there, at some point during that that page or this entry, you'll see links to a keyword or a set of keywords that'll essentially send you from that point to another point on the web wherein they make money. And typically speaking, they'll make money in the easiest way possible, like Google AdSense. So Blogspot has made the barrier of entry like so incredibly simple. Anybody could do it. Anybody could do it. That's the beauty of it. And it's its greatest weakness as well. So I was under attack. We're going to get the terrorists. I was under attack, and I wasn't the only one, but I didn't know that at the time. So with raw emotion, at 2 in the morning on Sunday, I posted I was so mad that Google had let it get to this point, because they had let it get to this point. And not to say that they'd willingly turn their back, because I don't think they did. I just don't think they were doing enough. So I posted something relatively dramatic. You know, kill Blogspot already. You know, if you're not going to take care of it, then get rid of it. Of course, you know, I realize there are plenty of legitimate users on the service, and they're not the people I'm complaining about. And I'm not complaining about Blogspot itself. But when I called Blogspot a crap farm, it wasn't so much that everything on Blogspot was a crap farm, it's just that they were fertile ground, and still are, for sploggers and splogs. Fertile ground. It's a crap farm. You know, insects invade your crop, and sometimes you gotta throw the baby out with the bathwater. Now, of course, that's not what I really, really wanted. I wanted Google to fix it. I don't want the service to disappear. But, of course, I made a very dramatic point. And I went to bed. I woke up the next morning and had like 10 some odd trackbacks to that article. I was like, whoa, that's pretty hefty for any kind of article. I was like, dang. So apparently I struck a nerve. And I wasn't the only one who struck a nerve, because concurrently with my post, Tim Bray had posted something, as well as Mark Cuban from Ice Rocket, and another individual, Matt Howie. If that's how you pronounce his last name. We all posted at the same time, or relatively the same time. I think I had the first post in, but essentially we all posted something about it without knowing that each other was posting about it. So people started going, well, what's going on here? What's happening? They thought there was a story. Well, I guess Sunday there was nothing else going on, so we had to complain about something in the blogosphere. And what we were complaining about is Google letting this thing, you know, kind of spin out of control. So, you know, people read the post, some people agreed, some people said, Chris, you were too harsh. Actually, not a lot of people did that. People who said that you didn't quite understand what it was that was going on. This isn't about comment spam and trackback spam. That's a headache of another breed. This is specifically about splogs, fake blogs that are diluting and polluting results that are, you know, outside the Google wall. Some would argue that, and I'm not necessarily one of them, that I should follow the money trail. I don't want to believe that. I don't want to believe that Google is listening to their shareholders instead of being a good citizen online. I don't want to believe that at all. So I waited just to see what everybody else was saying and doing, and we seemed to have struck a nerve. Then I decided to do a screencast, which sounds like absolute crap. No, I mean, I'm serious. It sounds like crap. But even though it sounds like crap, I want to play it back for you. Now, the reason why it sounds like crap is because my sound card is on the fritz. And I mean in a big way. Unfortunately, I need to replace the sound card on my main machine. And I just haven't gotten around to it yet. Remember we were talking about that, how I'm thinking about getting a new machine, but not sure which machine I want to get a hold of. Anyway, I recorded a screencast and tried to explain, you know, what was happening, what I was seeing. And let me just paraphrase it. I'm not going to play it back for you. Just, it sounds rotten. 400 items in a single folder, all of them spam, all of them sourced from blogspot.com. Now, at some point during the course of the day, some people were arguing, well, this is only happening to A-list bloggers and popular people, so doesn't matter. Now, you're not thinking this through. Today, it's a handful of people in a handful of terms. Tomorrow, it's you. It's your favorite stuff that gets spammed. So if Google doesn't take care of it now, where are we going to be a month from now, 2 months from now, 6 months from now, a year from now? We weren't complaining for the sake of complaining. Felt good to do, certainly, but we wanted Google to fix it. So as more and more blog posts came in and more people were linking and talking about it independently and linking to everybody else, or at least the people who kind of started this tirade, I heard from someone at Google, and they were saying, hey, you know, we thank you for bringing up this problem. Well, you know, we're going to address it on Monday. And that was good enough for me. And then I learned, after watching Trackbacks, that Evan Williams, one of the people from Pyro Labs, the founders of Blogger, which Google then acquired, basically posted something, and I think he was a little upset at my candor, stating something along the lines of, apparently, Google has a problem with spam. And I think that word was, I don't know why he used the word apparently. It kind of upset me, I can understand politically why he used the word apparently, but using the word apparently was the wrong word. Apparently is something that you say if you had no idea this was happening. But a lot of people knew that this was happening months ago. Not weeks, not days, not hours, not minutes. Months ago. Apparently, just didn't cut it. So I responded to Evan in my blog. I couldn't comment on his, and then he came back and he commented on mine, and we had a dialogue, a public one. And I kind of let things kind of settle for a while, posting, you know, further thoughts on the situation. Just the blogosphere was out of control. I mean, I got referenced a lot on Sunday. So Monday rolls around, Google posts something saying, here's what this is what we can do. They didn't say this is what we will do, this is what we can do. You know, it was something. I don't know if they're going to do it or how soon they're going to do it, but I offered a list of about 10 suggestions. Now, whether they're actually practical, that's not for me to decide. But at least I gave suggestions. At least I wasn't just saying, well, Google, you need to fix it. I was at least offering some help. Whether that help was warranted, whether it was valid, I'm not extending any kind of olive branch. Nobody's at war. I just want Google to fix their stuff. They're Google. This isn't some random search engine from Schenectady. No offense to any random search engines in Schenectady. This is Google. They have the power. Why didn't they do it before? What were they waiting for? They were very grateful that I had posted the suggestions, I believe. And the blogosphere has, of course, you know, continued to talk about this and the issue that now faces us. And the funny thing is we had this all kind of figured out within 24 hours, like what was going on, how people can move to resolve it. Google was aware of it. They had posted something by early on Monday. And just now, the press is getting a hold of it. Like, print and general web, you know, eWeek and whatnot, Information Week, and I guess the Wall Street Journal had sourced a couple of the later articles. They didn't get the full story, but they got enough to deliver the story. They left me out of it, which was kind of upsetting. But now the popular press, the big press, the mainstream press, is finally getting a hold of it a week after it happened. It's kind of funny. So when you see the next article on splogs and splogging and sploggers and blog spam, yeah, just a couple of us catalyzed that, and I think we've got Google's attention now. And I think I think in the next week or so, you're going to see a lot more attention being paid to this. Articles that are going in depth with this particular issue. It's not just Google's. Google is the tallest nail. It could very easily be MSN's problem with their spaces. Well, what keeps MSN spaces kind of protected is that Passport's a pain in the ass. Security through obscurity. And finally, Passport's useful. And I'm not saying that I've got a Passport account, I've got a Spaces account, I've got a Blogger account. I've got about every account known to man. So I've played with this stuff. But if it's not going to be Google, it's going to be somebody else. So if you're going to get into the vendor space to help people make blogs online, you better have your butt covered. You better figure out how the heck you're going to stop spammers from exploiting your service. Because once you dilute the blogosphere, man, that's a black eye that's going to stick on you for a long time. People don't have favorable comments for Blogspot. Some do. Some love it. But those tend to be the people who don't quite understand the bigger picture. The people who don't understand what's going on are the people who have 5 readers, very important readers, members of their family, friends, schoolmates, neighbors, small group of friends. The people who can see the forest through the trees are those who have been doing this for quite a while. So I think we've got Harold back. And he hung up.
He hung up. I should have got his number. We could have called him back.
Yeah, of course. Naturally. Well, yeah, I don't know what to do other than just call him on it. I mean, Google.
Not Harold. It's not Harold's fault.
No, it's not Harold's fault, certainly. I don't know what else to do, though. I can't just sit here idly by and just assume that someone else is going to take care of it.
See, I'm one of the people that's of the opinion that it's all about the money. They don't want to fix it.
Well, you know what? Then that goes against their very principle of do no evil.
I don't think you can operate in a do no evil principle and have shareholders.
Well,
not truly.
Yeah.
Do no evil.
At the same time, I don't know. I think if they're ever caught on that, they're just going to lose. They're going to lose face. And I don't know if they're willing to risk that. And I understand the money trail leads to people who are exploiting it. And Google is basically, they've got the disease and kind of I don't know if I'd say cure. They do know how to cure it, but they don't want to. And of course, you know, tons of blogs are added every single day, I'm sure. But if Google doesn't curb that, we're going to end up with more junk than actual content, or at least seemingly so. Seemingly so. Of course, none of my numbers are scientific.
You know, in a way, though, I kind of view the problem with Blogspot and Google. It would be like it would be like Norton releasing a virus in the wild to try to get you to buy antivirus or something like that.
Yeah.
It's not quite the same thing.
Some people have said that, you know, it behooves Norton to do that.
There is a certain theory that the antivirus community at large, not pointing at any one specific company, does things to propagate the viruses that
I can
that are
believe
out
it.
There.
That I believe. Of course, what's odd is when Microsoft releases their OneCare service, they're going to charge for it, which I believe is a little rude. That's like saying, here, buy the disease. Oh, here's the cure. That'll be another $19.95.
Well, it depends on how they implement it. If they implement some base level of service for free and you're actually getting some value above and beyond a core protection.
I don't know. I smell antitrust, and of course Norton's crying foul, and I said, well, I'm shedding absolutely no tears for Norton and Symantec. They've been making crapware for years. Used to be essential that you had Norton products on your system. I wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole.
I wouldn't buy
them. I don't trust anybody who recommends Norton software. I just don't, because I've had experience with it. And it's not that good. It's got a brand, great. And they're like I said, they're upset that Windows is doing this or Microsoft's doing this. I say, sorry, dude. Should have treated us better when you had the chance. We'd be strong to your brand. We'd believe in your brand. Well, I believe their brand. I just don't believe it's that good.
Well, you know, some people aspire to mediocrity.
Yeah, I guess. Well, it's a lot of companies out there. And surprisingly enough, Microsoft's going to do better, I think, with OneCare than a lot of the other services I've seen.
If the antivirus product that they already have in beta is any indication, they're already doing better. In my opinion.
That number will probably increase. The laziness of some people, and OEMs, of course, will strike deals with Norton. That's the only way. Oh, my God.
But we've got...
You talk about spyware. Anyway, not spyware, crapware, malware, anything from Norton or McAfee.
We've got Ed, Edbot on the
line. Oh, okay, so we should
probably bring
Ed on. Sure. Ed? Oh, boy. Ed?
Yes.
Hey.
Hey.
Sorry that you had to live through my partial rant there.
I couldn't hear a thing, actually.
Oh, you couldn't hear a thing?
No.
I was basically, I wasn't complaining. I was saying that Norton should have treated us better when they had the chance, because their software sucks, and now Windows One Care is going to sweep in and kind of save the day. I'm of that opinion.
I would have been ranting right alongside you.
So you're also one who believes that Symantec software just has sucked for the longest time.
I no longer recommend it to anyone.
Okay, then I trust you automatically. No, I'm serious. I don't trust anybody who would sit there and say that, you know, just install Norton, just install Symantec, just install McAfee. I don't...
Right.
It's...
To me, if someone has already got it installed, if they've already paid for it, and it seems to be working for them, I'll say, fine, use it until the subscription runs out. And then switch to something better.
I won't even go that far.
You know.
I say uninstall the damn thing. Get your money back if you can. This guy
get
is
your
falling.
Money back if you can, but, you know, I mean, you're gonna tear your hair out and spend hours on the phone doing that.
Have you seen the new Windows One Care service?
I'm using it, beta testing it.
Okay, yeah, as am I. I've seen screenshots of either an upcoming version, or maybe it's the current build. I haven't seen it, but it's integrated now with the anti-spyware utility, it seems.
I have not seen that yet. I've seen little hints and bits and pieces of it here and there.
Well, it makes sense to have that wrapped within that interface, and
right.
It is... For all intent and purpose, it's a pretty solid interface.
Right, and I think I said the other day on my site that, you know, anybody who tries to make an antitrust complaint on the basis of this just should be beaten about the head and shoulders.
Yeah, because everything else sucks.
Everything else sucks, and it ought to be in the operating system.
Yep.
If somebody can come up with something that's better, has more features, blah, 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 and it's worth paying extra for, fine.
That was the whole premise behind Norton. You know, back with Norton Commander and, you know, Norton Utilities. I mean, way back in the DOS days.
Exactly.
That was the whole idea, is that you could buy something that made Windows better.
They were the value-added proposition.
Yeah.
You can take the baseline level that comes with your OS, or you can pay extra and get something that's really cool. And, Norton Desktop for Windows, I mean, come on, you know? It's like, I'm getting all schmoopy just thinking about it.
Well, that's, it's interesting. And I'm see if you'll follow me here. I think it's important, I agree, to be at the operating system level with this kind of software, but I think it's a little rude to sell the disease and the cure. I'm of the mindset that Windows One Care, and I realize the antitrust people would just be screaming and beating me about the head. But I think it's rude to have Windows and say, oh, well, One Care service is X dollars a month.
I agree. It should be free.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's the disease and the cure.
Right, which, of course, is the problem with all security software.
In what way?
Right now, okay, let's just hypothetically say that you've got two security programs. We'll call them, oh, I don't know, Norton and McAfee. Just, you know, we'll just pick those two names out of the air, right? And so you install those on two separate machines side by side. And one of them starts identifying false positives left and right. It keeps telling you all day long, I just protected you from this, that, and the other thing. And it gives you 20 messages telling you how it protected you. The other one says, nope, nothing happened today. The average, unsophisticated, trusting computer user is going to say, I think this one that protected me 20 times today is the one that I should pay for because it's so much better. Even though every single one of those warnings was a false positive or misleading or identifying something that really isn't a threat after all, there's a powerful incentive for people in the security software industry to identify things and make you feel afraid so that you'll feel like they're protecting you.
Hmm. Now, do you consider spyware a form of terrorism?
Wow.
I was just going to make that leap there. I just figured I'd throw that out.
Well, you know, boy, what a loaded word. I wouldn't call it terrorism, but I would call it vandalism and theft and, you know, a whole bunch of things that are pretty close to it. But a lot of the anti-spyware companies, I mean, like, you know, the ones that you know, will pop up a whole screen full of stuff where they found, you know, 200 cookies on your computer and tell you, you know, they protected you from these horrible threats. I mean, that's like changing the threat level from, you know, puce to yellow on you.
Puce. I haven't heard that word in
weeks.
Yeah, weeks at least. Yeah, last time I think I heard it was on Wikipedia. So now, Ed, we should get into introducing you, I guess, at this point. How would you introduce yourself?
An award-winning technology journalist and a best-selling author of more than a dozen books on Microsoft Windows and Microsoft Office.
So you've got a certain amount of expertise in discussing these matters.
Some people think so.
And now you're blogging, of course.
I'm blogging.
Took you long enough.
Multi-blogging. Chris, it'll be my third anniversary in December of this year.
Really? Third?
Third.
Well,
3 years.
Maybe I just only reading you forever, but only started following your blog recently.
You know, I did. I do have to confess that I stayed pretty low-key with it for the first, like, year and a half or so.
Okay.
I'd say it was about a year, 14, 15 months ago where I said, okay, I guess this blogging thing's for real. and really started making and you know, I look at the stats since then and, you know, it's just mind boggling. When you start taking things seriously, when you start taking your audience seriously, they really respond.
And most of your content is based on Windows, at least on your primary blog.
Primary blog, everything is pretty much based on, you know, Windows and Office and a few things that I find interesting that are sort of tangentially related. And then the secondary one is all Media Center focused, which, and I decided to spin that one off because I kind of recognized that while people are passionate about Media Center and the technology and digital media and all that, it's also still a minority thing. So a bunch of people really love it. A bunch of other people would go, you know, I'm not running Media Center, I'm not interested in it. So I decided to spin that off and give people an opportunity to, you know, opt in.
Now give me a good synopsis of this recent roll-up for Media Center Edition, if you can. The good, the bad, the ugly.
Okay. Well, it's the equivalent of an annual service pack thing that the Media Center team does every year. And they rolled a whole bunch of stuff into what they're calling update roll-up 2 for Windows XP Media Center Edition 2005.
Wow.
I like the code name Emerald.
Yeah.
A hell of a lot better. But and it has a bunch of cool new features in it that will be useful to you at some time in the future when you get the hardware that, you know, relates to them. So it supports an Xbox 360 extender, which is pretty cool. If you download a high-definition file on your main Media Center box, you can send it to your Xbox 360 and watch high-definition content in your living room without having to have a noisy computer in there.
Really? Wait, I thought they weren't rolling out the HDTV support here.
The HDTV support has actually been in Media Center since last December. It's the it's support for encrypted high-definition signals that come in via cable and satellite that's missing.
That's what
If you download a high-definition file or if you record an HDTV program from an over-the-air tuner, then you can watch that on your Media Center PC, and you can stream it over your Xbox 360 when they're finally available for sale if you want to pay the $399.
Oh, yeah. Of course I do.
Yeah.
No, I pre-ordered mine. Make no mistake.
I'm waiting until they show up on eBay. It supports a new hardware mode called Away Mode, which is a very fast off, very fast on. It's like standby on steroids. The new update roll-up, but again, that's in, I think I just saw the first piece of hardware that supports this, the new Shuttle M1000. First Media Center PC that I've seen that supports Away Mode. It's not going to roll out for another 3 to 6 months in more mainstream computers. CD and DVD changers, so you can have a 200 DVD jukebox hooked up to your Media Center PC, and, you know, it's why anybody in 2005 would want that, kind of beyond me, but hey, it will be supported. And actually, the same technology, the same functionality will support if you have ripped DVDs into files that are supported by the Media Center decoders, then you can have a virtual DVD changer so that you can quickly switch in between different ripped DVDs on a big hard drive.
BitTorrent, here I come.
You can throw an extra HDTV tuner into your Media Center PC with update roll-up 2. So you can have two HDTV tuners doing only over-the-air HDTV and two standard definition tuners. So you could conceivably, if you have enough signal sources coming in there, be recording four programs at once.
Wow.
Which means you're going to have to stop sleeping in order to watch all the stuff that's on your Media Center. But hey, there you go. And then, most of that stuff is stuff that you and I are not going to be able to take advantage of because we don't have the hardware for it or the market hasn't caught up. But there's also, in Update Roll-Up 2, a bunch of bug fixes, some minor performance improvements, a new Zoom mode, which is actually pretty cool, that does what a lot of high-end TVs do. When you're watching something that's in, you know, the standard square 4:3 ratio,
mm-hmm.
you can zoom it so it'll fill your big widescreen 16:9 TV, and it will leave the center of the screen pretty much unstretched and sort of increase the stretching as it goes to the outside. They call it the panoramic stretching on some TVs. And it actually, you know, I hate the ones that stretch your standard definition signal uniformly because it makes everyone look like Fat Arnold.
Yep, seen that.
But when you use this, it's Zoom 4 mode from your Media Center remote control, and it actually looks fairly natural. That's kind of a new thing.
Hmm.
And a couple of other fairly minor things. Oh, one feature that actually restarts the Media Center shell once a day.
Why?
In the middle of the night, presuming you're not doing something else.
Wait a minute. Is this hidden or is it automatic?
It is a feature that is buried under the settings menu. It's not enabled by default. It's under the optimize heading. Yeah. And so you turn this on, you go in there and you say enable optimize, and then you give it a time. It suggests 4 a.m. And so it just, what it does is it just restarts the shell, the EH shell component.
Wait. So they know it's not doing well, so their workaround was to set up a cron job for it to restart.
Basically, you know, because I mean, I had this discussion with some of the folks on the eHome, the Media Center team, you know, and I said, you know, because what you're doing is you're sending the message out here to people by introducing this feature that, you know, Media Center is not very stable and you need to kind of kickstart it, you know, once a day to keep it from crashing. And it's not, you know, they say, and I believe them, honest, that really isn't the problem. But what they've found is that there's a lot of third-party junk out there, or a small amount of third-party junk out there, but a significant, but just enough to create problems, and they can work around some of the third-party problems by restarting the thing once a day.
Isn't that kind of like what we used to do with NT4?
With NT4 and with Windows 98, I mean, as you'll probably recall, Windows 98 had a bug where I think it was like at 40, if you could actually get it to run for 40 days without crashing.
Yeah, I remember.
It would then crash on you, as if to say to you, you fool.
Yeah, but I don't know if anybody ever recorded that crash.
I'm not sure that I ever made it 40 days.
It took them years to discover this bug, which ought to tell you something. but that's sort of the, you know, one of the features that's in, you know, so and then if you're, and I will take a little heat for this, because I have been unfairly US centric in my view towards update roll up 2, and I had some of the folks over in the UK remind me that there are actually some really interesting features in update roll-up 2 of Media Center for people who are running it in the UK. They, lucky devils, get something called DVPT, which is radio signals that come in over a cable, as I'm told. I've never really experienced this firsthand, so I don't know. But they can actually pause and rewind and time shift live radio. And there was a bug in Media Center 2005 anyway they've got this support in Update Rollup 2, and then in the patch to Update Rollup 2, which came out I think 4 hours after it was made widely available to ordinary users, that fixed a bug in the DVPT support. But if you're actually in the UK and you like radio, you can get the ability to pause, rewind, and time shift live radio, which I wish we had here.
I thought we did. Doesn't the FM tuner do that? I mean, on the Media Center, at least I believe I've done pre-record. I've done it with NPR on the Media Center.
You can't pause and back up.
I don't think you can use it on the FM tuner part. You can use it when you're doing the NPR mode from Online Spotlight.
Yeah.
What you're doing is just you're downloading
I gotcha.
Yeah,
okay.
which is great.
Yeah.
I use that all the time, and it's really nice to be able to sort of pick and choose my NPR.
But that's kind of what podcasting came in and
well, right. You know, that's like, you know, the thinnest possible sliver of podcasting.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised that this rollout, or Emerald, as it were, which is much easier to say, far less syllables. I'm surprised that they hadn't packed more features in there as kind of a holdover between now and the Vista timeframe. Surprised.
Technically,
yeah. Well, for example, podcasting. I mean, some kind of robust podcasting solution. Well, you know what I think, though. One of the big deals is, I think people have the notion that Microsoft, because they're, you know, they have $55 billion in cash, or maybe it's up to $155 billion now, and, you know, more, and that Bill Gates is more powerful than, you know, any human being on the planet, that they can do, that all they have to do is write something down on a piece of paper and hand it to somebody and it just gets done. And I think that there's actually, you know, finite developer resources and you know, third parties that like want to have some say so over how a feature gets implemented and stuff. And I think that it's the frustrating thing is that they did a fair amount of stuff in Update Rollup 2, although it wasn't very exciting for the people who are the, you know, dedicated consumers of it, but it was actually a fairly significant effort for them.
Now, and
finding people who can write this code isn't all that easy.
Oh, and I can understand that.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly I know Microsoft's always hiring developers. There's no shortage of positions that are open in any department.
Exactly.
The thing I wanted to really bring up tonight, you know, beyond discussing ins and outs of Emerald, at least on the surface, was Apple's entry into this particular arena.
Yep.
Or should I say non-entry? Or pseudo-entry. They've got, what is it called, bathroom? Back
front,
room? I can't.
Front row?
Front row.
Front
row? Front row or front room?
Front row. That's the Australian version.
Oh, okay.
Front row.
So Apple now is they're not exactly going after the media center,
no,
but they're kind of trying to, maybe, sorta.
Well, you know, as big as those IMAX screens are now, it's almost a TV.
Yeah. Well, I think so too.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I mean, I don't have any hands-on experience with it. All I did was I watched the streamcast of it like everybody else, and then I looked at some screenshots of it to me, and you know, and it's a, I mean, I think it's a good, it looks like a good competitor. I'm not trying to be a smartass here. It looks like a good competitor to Media Center 2002.
Well, Jason Dunn from Digital Media Thoughts essentially echoes those sentiments.
Yeah. It has two big weaknesses to me. Number one is no TV tuner. And number two is that it only runs on a particular iMac model with the built-in screen. So you can't sort of feed it, you know, it's not a living room solution. It's a dorm room solution.
Ah.
You know, and so I think what they're trying to do is, what it looks like is, you know, the whole market that the iPod and the Nano and the Photo and the Video and the whole thing is aimed after a bunch of people who are in a certain, you know, in that sort of 18 to 29 demographic, living in small spaces, either in their parents' house or a college dorm room or a small apartment, where the primary media center is the screen on their computer and the speakers that are attached to it. You know, and so in an environment like that, where, you know, you don't have a hell of a lot of disposable income, and you don't have a lot of space for, you know, putting together a, you know, a killer home theater thing, then it makes some sense. But it's not. But that's not the market for Media Center, mm-hmm. and that's not the market for Myth TV or Beyond TV or TiVo. Or the stuff that's coming from your cable company, either.
Well, I can tell you that, you know, Apple's sexy. I mean, seriously, Apple. If there's a computer I would want to sleep with, it would be Apple.
You know, you'd probably want two of them.
Well, a menage de trois, I guess.
Just the kind of guy, you know.
Yeah, you never know. I think if they ever do take it seriously,
yeah.
You know, certainly I would. I would take them more seriously if they took it seriously.
And you also have to understand, you know, and I mean, I think that, you know, some jaws in the Apple-loving crowd will drop at this, but I think that Apple can move very, very quickly on things like this, and I think it's foolish of anybody at Microsoft, in the analyst community, or in the people buying this stuff to say, oh, well, they blew their opportunity here. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, 6 months from now, they could have a, you know, something that takes the Mac Mini platform, adds a little slice on the bottom of it, and, you know, boom, they've got a media center alternative. And they can roll that out very, very quickly. The thing that's going to get in their way is the bureaucracy of arranging, you know, the technology to decode this stuff as it comes in.
All they have to do to move more Macs is say iPod compatible.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, seriously, and I am not an iPod fan. Some people hate me for the things I say about the iPod, and I can't say that I've gone gaga or even close to going. I haven't even gone gah over the iPod video device, and I honestly believe whether it's That's So Raven or Lost, I don't think that $1.99 per episode is anywhere near the value of that episode.
Actually, if you could get it on DVD in 480p, then the market would suggest that it is worth that, because that's what people are essentially paying for a season of a show right now for most shows, in the $35 to $40 range.
But you can only access it in 320 by 240.
I agree.
So, and the quality of that is substantial. That's below television quality
standards.
You know,
and the thing is, I had an Apple. I had the equivalent of an iPod video in 2001.
Yeah, like 4 years ago.
It was called the Jukebox Multimedia from Archeos, and it played MPEG-4 content on a postage stamp size screen, just like the iPod video.
Yeah,
and it would record.
And I'm sure you had parties every Friday night where you invited your friends over to come, you know, pull up chairs and sit, you know, with their faces like 18 inches away from your computer screen to watch those things.
You know, the thing that I go back to is, and I watch stuff on all kinds of crazy small screens just because I like to hack around at the media and see what I can do. And it goes back to people look over my shoulder on an airplane and ask how the hell I can possibly watch a screen that small.
Exactly. They go, damn, you are way geek.
Yeah, I mean...
But a lot of people, you know about the iPod, whether they have one or not.
Correct.
And the simplicity of it is certainly, that cannot be argued. I take issue, and as I've written about this week, with the issue of convergence. And each vendor is trying to own the market, and that's really pissing me off.
Right.
I mean, to the point where I've come out and said, convergence is already happening, it's just very messy. And I think Apple's, they're kind of getting it, because as I understand it, you could pay for an episode, burn it to a CD, and then, you know, it's yours. I mean, there's no DRM that's slapped on it. And I don't know, this is what I've heard. I don't actually have one. I've never actually bought one. I don't have an iTunes subscription.
I purchased one, but I didn't try to burn it to a DVD, so I can't say for sure whether it burns to a DVD or not. But watching it 320 by 240 for 45 minutes of Desperate Housewives.
Well, I can tell you, as far as putting it on the PSP is concerned, great. And I believe PSP MP4, iPod Video MP4, there's something going on there. There's a format that's going on right there that I believe now Microsoft needs to be a little more serious about supporting that.
Right.
Inherently supporting MP4. Because right now it's just done by I've got to download a codec pack to install something so that I can play MP4s on my machine. And to tell you the truth, they don't play all that well.
The average Windows user should never feel, taste, or experience in any way the word codec.
Yeah. Oh, dear God. From your lips to God's ears.
But on the price, on that $1.99 price, I'm gonna quibble with the fact that it's, you know, I don't think it's right. I think the fair comparison is not buying a season of DVDs. It's renting a season of DVDs. And you know what? You can each DVD typically holds three episodes, right? Mm-hmm. So I can go down to Blockbuster, or I can do it on Netflix. And so for somewhere in the vicinity of $3, $3.50, $4, I can watch three episodes of Lost or Desperate Housewives or Nip Tuck or 24 or whatever my favorite program is. For $3, $3.50, or $4, I can usually keep it for a week or more. And, you know, compare that to the $6 that iTunes wants to charge me for those three episodes that have to be viewed in a little tiny window and will just look god-awful if they're blown up on even a 25-inch TV screen.
And for whatever it's worth, I just got word from a listener, Jeff Murray, and he was saying that no burning is allowed for the videos. So it decimates the value of...
Well, that matches what I had heard, too, but yeah. I didn't, you know, I don't like
well,
to... You know,
speculate
I don't like to pass
rumor,
along rumors.
Right. And it's from what I've seen, though, they had a slide that was posted to the web about their DRM strategy. And from what I saw on that slide, and I can't remember it verbatim, but I remember reading it and going, wow, that's not that bad. It wasn't horrible for me. What I want to see is, I think you're talking around this too, is a subscription-based model for music, shows, videos, whatever it happens to be.
Exactly.
That's the Napster. If I can get a Napster on an iPod, I would take the iPod seriously. And right now I'm hacking together convergence. You know, I'm using BitTorrent, and
right.
You know, I'm transcoding into MP4 and watching the shows or movies that I want to watch on my PSP. I'm not a freeloader. I've got a Netflix account. I could get the DVDs. I've got a Napster account. I could get the music. I'm paying $80 a month to Comcast, if not more, to get access to as many movie channels as they possibly have. I'm not freeloading. I've got access to the content. It's just not coming to me on my terms, and that's frustrating.
Exactly.
And I don't see Microsoft taking it seriously. They're still wrapped up in their own brand. I mean, yes, they support MP3 and WMA. Great. Okay, now it's time for you guys to support MP4. I think with the PSP getting to... And here's the thing that really pisses me off, by the way, as an aside, is when I get a message from someone from Microsoft trying to combat the PSP or the iPod with a portable media center, which, in
right.
my opinion, was an absolute joke.
You know, the Portable Media Center has the same lousy 320x240 resolution that Apple's supporting.
And it wasn't sexy.
And it
and
cost
it was
too
overpriced.
Much.
I mean, the iPod's overpriced, but the PMC was really overpriced.
Well, you know, if you're going to watch something at 320x240 in something that fits in your hand, I don't have a problem with the quality of the image there.
Well, but see, the thing is, and this is the thing that they've done on both the iPod Video and Microsoft did with the Portable Media Center, they give you a TV out option. If you give me a TV out option, I better get TV quality.
Right.
Because otherwise, yeah. Otherwise, don't bother.
Right.
And honestly, when I download for the PSP, I'm looking for widescreen stuff, HDTV or widescreen.
Right. We're just, you know, nobody is there yet. I mean, we are so... This is bleeding edge here. There isn't even any blood that has reached the edge that's being cut yet. You know, it's. I mean, we're still, from a technological point of view, thanks to DRM, primarily, we're still, you know, probably 2 years away from having things at the point where you can say, okay, I can shift it from, you know, point A to point B to point C, and even 2 years from now is iffy because it depends on a lot of people who have, you know, sort of it's like the Security Council at the UN. There's always, you know, one party can veto the whole thing and ruin it for everybody. And that's, you know, that's sort of the media, you know, when you talk about convergence right now, the only way that convergence works is through unanimity. And trying to get all these greedy, selfish people to be unanimous is difficult.
Well, I think it's going to be something like a BitTorrent, like a Kazaa, Napster. I mean, original Napster. It's going to take a groundswell of support from the bottom.
Right.
I mean, not to say bottom feeders. I mean, just the bottom of the chain, as far as like individuals to corporations. If there is a chain.
Yeah, right, of people finally saying, look, I don't want to be a crook. I have no desire to engage in illegal behavior, but you give me no choice. You won't allow me to do simple, logical things, things that are not infringing in any rational definition of the term, but you won't let me do it, and so therefore I'm going to find the alternative ways of doing it, and they're all going to be offshore.
Well, that's it's sad. It really is sad. I've come out And I've actually said, yes, I download shows. Yes, I download music. But I also, if you come after me, all I'm going to do is point to my Napster subscription, point to my cable subscription, point to my Netflix subscription, and say, what's your problem?
Right.
What's your problem?
I read something from a blogger a couple weeks ago. He's a venture capitalist, fairly, you probably know his name.
Is it Fred from OVC?
No, different guy. I'm not gonna mention his name because it's not relevant. But at any rate, he said almost exactly the same thing. He said, "Look, I download shows via BitTorrent to my computer." He says, "Look, I've got a cable subscription. I've got a Netflix subscription. I've got DirecTV.
Yeah.
I've bought a lot of these DVDs, but I can't get these things out of these things that I paid huge amounts of money for, have lined the pockets of the content producers, and so this is the easiest way for me to get them. Do I feel guilty about it? No, not even for a second. I already paid for this thing."
Yep.
You know, and I mean, I think that's the thing that you're saying, and that's what I agree with. I mean, you read Walt Mossberg's column yesterday, right?
I haven't caught it yet.
Ah, well, he came out with a finely parsed anti DRM thing where he said, you know, the content producing industry should come up with a new form of DRM that doesn't penalize innocent people but that stops serious pirates.
DRM is for marketers.
Right. There's no such thing as a little DRM. You know?
it either is or it isn't.
It either is or it isn't. If you accept the reality that DRM is acceptable and necessary to protect intellectual property, then you have to start deciding how much inconvenience and hassle you want to put up with. But you can't just say, "I want only the good DRM, not the bad stuff."
You know, in a lot of ways, 321 Studios DVD X copy did it right because they watermarked their files with a number that was associated with the purchaser of their software, so that if you were engaging in selling copies, they could trace it back to the person that made the purchase.
Yep.
And I don't see anything wrong with that at all. Because if I'm making copies for myself, it's not hurting anything. If I'm making copies to make a profit, it causes a problem.
And they even say that in when you're fast forward,
yeah,
when you're trying to fast forward through the FBI notice, they pretty much say the same thing. Like, you can't do like a public exhibition of whatever may be on the screen.
Oh, I always thought that was the part where I'm supposed to go make popcorn.
Well, yes.
It doesn't last quite long enough.
That's actually now the commercials that you have to sit through or fast forward through when you put in a DVD.
Yeah.
Commercials. I understand it's teasing. It's making more selling points once you have the DVD. Once you have a customer, it's easier to keep the customer than it is.
You know, if I watch indie DVDs, though, I'm happy that they have the commercials because it's like stuff that I definitely wouldn't have had on my
trailers.
Radar.
Right. Yeah. Trailers. Yeah. I don't mind trailers in the movie theater, but I mind them a lot with the DVD.
They should be optional.
Let me choose to watch them.
Yeah. Yeah. You got trailer? Okay. Sure. Yeah.
Give them to me as bonus content. I am fine with that.
Certainly.
You know, but you know, the other thing that Walt said, which I agree with, he said that consumers, use that word, should stop buying copy-protected CDs.
I agree.
And I completely agree with that. In fact, I don't buy CDs anymore from RIAA. I just don't.
Wait a minute. That's about every CD that's out there.
You know what? It isn't. There are thousands, hundreds, and probably thousands of great artists who are on independent labels, and you know, self-produced and stuff. I listen to lots and lots and lots of new music all the time, and you know, it ain't U2, and it ain't Paul McCartney, and it, you know, and you know, and Coldplay and all these people, and they can just all go, not interested. You know, if they happen to come up on a radio station that I'm listening to, that's fine. But there's, you know, I just got a copy of a couple of CDs from Alison Moore that are on Rounder Records, nice, great independent label, Alison Krauss and Union Station on Sugar Hill. You know, there's eMusic. The eMusic service has...
Oh, God. eMusic screwed their customers when they changed their model, in my opinion.
That's what I thought, and I canceled my subscription 2 years ago, and I've come back to them now, and they've got lots of great stuff there, and I'm paying an average of, you know, somewhere around $5 for a CD's equivalent of stuff. Very high bit rate, un-DRM protected, all of it from indie media, and a lot of just great stuff. I mean, I just, you know, the mainstream commercial things that comes from there's four record labels now, right?
Jake, you'd know better.
Four record labels for
music?
For the RIAA, if you boil it all down, you get the people, you get the companies that are...
Warner Brothers, Atlantic.
Well, there's five primary ones. I mean, there's Roadrunner Records, there's Warner Brothers, there's Sony, which is Columbia.
EMI.
EMI, and I think that BMG is still, or BMG Universal, I think, are one and the same.
Okay, right. So you've got basically five labels, and you know what? If I cut them out, they're still. If I just say I don't want anything to do with you people, there's still an incredible wide world of independent music out there, and I don't seem to have any trouble finding really fascinating, interesting stuff to listen to all the time.
See, I guess I don't. I mean, I listen to music certainly, but I don't spend so much time with music that I do much exploring with independent stuff. I mean, if it's on, it's on. You know, if someone recommends it, it's there. But that's usually how I take music these days, and that's I am usually pretty happy with.
If you think about it, the people who make it to the point where they have a contract with one of those big five record labels, they're people who've managed to go through sort of a winnowing process, much of which is just being able to suck up to the business side. You know?
Pretty much.
And, I mean, it's...
Understanding the marketing machine.
Yeah. And you know, so, I mean, I would say it's the equivalent of, do you want to listen to any of the 1,000 podcasts and independent broadcasts that are out there from around the world, not just in the United States, or do you want to listen to a Clear Channel station? Take your choice.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting, and it's very much related to this discussion, but some people have raised the point that iPod video should have local affiliates worried. Local Fox affiliates, NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, UPN, if you count them as a network.
Yeah.
Should be really worried about what's happening now. Do you have a take on that? If you've even thought about it.
I thought about it for about, 10 seconds or so, and I just so don't care whether, Disney or Viacom or GE... or Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, right? Because those are the four gigantic corporate owners of the four major American networks, which then, feed pablum down to the local affiliates and stuff. And, if any one of those are going to go broke, I don't have any tears for any of them.
What are they going to do? I know you don't have any tears, but they're just going to just wither up and die?
No, they'll, they're big corporations. They'll find a way to, they find a way to keep people entertained. Where video is right now with the corporate affiliates or with the affiliates of the big gigantic corporate networks, right? That's where the major record labels were 7 years ago when Napster first appeared, right? I don't really see any of those big record labels in danger of going out of business.
Well, you know, the affiliates are kind of in a different situation, though. Not to say that they have any excuses, but
yeah.
But I mean, they sort of are in a different situation than the record labels because they're entirely dependent on advertising embedded in those shows to make money, and on the affiliate relationship that they have with the content provider. Now, that said, that I think that the ABC affiliates just re-upped their contracts like less than a year ago, and so they have like about 5 years to figure out what they're going to do.
Right. Well, but really what you're describing is not unique to the phenomenon that's going on here with downloadable content. It's a byproduct of the whole notion of alternative distributions of media, right? You own a TiVo or a media center or a cable company distributed DVR or something from DirecTV, and so all of a sudden, you know, you have the option to start skipping commercials.
People are doing it now.
People have been doing it for 5 or 6 years
since the VCR.
You know, and actually something that's interesting, 60 Minutes, I think this coming Sunday, 60 Minutes is going to only have one sponsor for the entire show.
Yeah, you talk about going back in time. I mean, that's what the networks were like in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had the Colgate Palmolive Theater, or you had Texaco presents the Milton Berle Show. That's that's what you. So I'm told.
Or you have Microsoft Windows Media presents the Chris Perillo Show.
Yes, as it were.
Yeah, you know, and so I mean, you're going back. I mean, people, you know, it's I don't think it's the fact that some little disruptive shift comes in the distribution mechanism for media that's going to affect the affiliates or people so much as just the complete disruption of the whole broadcast medium. You know, that's what the real problem is. I mean, how relevant is that? How much viewership have those network affiliates lost in the last, say, 15 years since the explosion of cable that kind of began with CNN and the first Gulf War,
yeah,
right?
Based on the number of shows that are winning awards on HBO and Showtime, I would suggest that probably quite a few people have abandoned ship.
Yeah, I mean, I think the numbers, you know, the numbers are. I mean, there's a you know, major compression, like, you know, a half or a third, and so, you know, I'd say, well, affiliates, figure out how to make a living in the new world, and if you can't, then prepare to disappear. And if you disappear, well, guess what? That's four channels on my local box out of 500 that have disappeared.
Yeah.
See, my prediction is that we're going to see, and I'm definitely not unique in this perspective, that we're going to see more independently produced content showing up on the affiliate type stations, that it's going to be smaller syndication networks are going to crop up to compete with ABC and NBC and the big studios, because there's going to be this void of, well, I can get that content somewhere else and it doesn't generate the same ad dollars as if we have something that's independently produced.
You're probably right, but still, their economic model is based on being able to charge a lot of money, or a very small amount of money per viewer for a lot of viewers.
Yeah, certainly.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas the model that you and I want to work on, or that a small niche channel is going to be, say, we're going to have a small but very targeted viewership that is going to be receptive to a message that an advertiser wants to present, and the advertiser is going to want to pay a relatively high amount of money and give a respectful, relevant message to those people, instead of, you know, you and I sitting down, you know, to watch the evening news and seeing, you know, a bunch of ads for hemorrhoid medicine and
hey, now,
cream.
You never know. I, you know, don't automatically think that just because I look young doesn't mean that. Here's a joke for you. Two kids, two little boys, walk into a drugstore, and they go pick up a product for females, and they take it to the counter. And the shopkeep says, "Hang on, you know what this is?" And one of the kids says, "No." He said, "You know this isn't for you, right?" He said, "No, I know it's not for me. It's for my brother." He said, why are you getting it for your brother? "Well, because he can't swim, and he can't ride a bike, and apparently if you buy these things, you can do both."
All they need is beer next, and then they can meet some girls.
Yeah, but you can't swim with beer. They tell you not to do that. I don't know.
Yeah, right.
Speaking of, you know, I don't want to suck up too much of your evening here, Ed. We certainly appreciate the time.
Yep.
Beer. The segue is, you know, you'd probably be rather drinking beer than...
I would rather go back to... I've only had 3 or 4 beers tonight already, and so I need to go have the rest of them now.
There you go. way to
it's
unwind.
It's been fun.
Oh, certainly. We'll do it again.
Let's do this again.
For sure.
Okay.
Ed Bott of edbott.com. We certainly appreciate the time.
Thanks a lot, guys. See you later.
Sure. Take care.
The Windows Media Stream for the live broadcast of the Chris Perillo Show is provided by Limelight Networks. Listen to the live Chris Perillo Show in Windows Media Player. Download the latest version of the player for Mac and Windows users at Microsoft.com/Windows Media.